Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with poet Niyo Sundari, whose new book is If Only the Road Could Talk, Poetic Peregrinations in Africa, Asia, and Europe. And I'll have a look back at 2017. Niyo Sundari makes his home in New Orleans, is a native of Nigeria, but as his new collection of poems makes clear, he is a citizen of the world. If Only the Road Could Talk is a collection of, as the subtitle says, poetic peregrinations in Africa, Asia, and Europe. Niyo has received Nigeria's highest award for creative intellectual achievements, the National Order of Merit, and he is presently a distinguished professor of English here at the University of New Orleans. Niyo Sundari, I'm so happy to welcome you back to The Reading Life.
It is my pleasure, Susan. Thank you for inviting me again.
Oh, always. Mm. Now, these poems in If Only the Road Could Talk are inspired by your travels, and they were written over many, many years. Did it surprise you how all this experience added up when you came to choose the poems for this book?
Yes. First of all, the very inspiration itself. I'm Yoruba. In Yoruba culture, it's often said that when you haven't seen the farms of other people, you don't say, oh, my father's farm is the largest in the world. Travel, go around, see people. And in high school, I was lucky to be a student in a school. It was a small school in Ikere Ekiti. And our principal called us in 1962, I think, said, my boys, it was a boarding school for boys, just 83 of us. Homely kept children, we only have homely wit. If we're going to be the leaders of this country tomorrow, you will have to know the kind of country you're going to lead. So next term, I'm organizing an excursion. And he did. So right from the time I was a boy, I've been trying to see as many parts of the world as possible. And I have been lucky because my writing has taken me to different places. Nearly all the places mentioned here I have been to on invitation. And I've also been in the company of other writers. And that is very, very important. Our world is a beautiful place, but extremely complex, extremely difficult. This is what I've discovered. When people say there is nothing new under the sky, they are partly right, partly correct. As I said in the introduction, in the preface, so many of the things I see in different parts of the world remind me of the things I saw when I was growing up in Nigeria. Our world is one. Mm-hmm.
You know? Well, I love that so many of these poems are literary and inspiration, because for me, travel is often literary. It's, you go to see places where writers live and work. And in Berlin, you visit Bertolt Brecht's home.
Yes. Oh, Bertolt Brecht, whom I call the Shakespeare of Germany. I got introduced to the works of Bertolt Brecht as an undergraduate in Nigeria, and I instantly took a great liking for him. Extremely creative, mischievous, humorous, witty, political, and very humane. At times, I don't know whether is just a play, is which one is greater at, playwriting or poetry, because many people overlook his poetry. His poems are also fantastic, you know, satirical and very, very thoughtful. So it was 1993. I was a member of an international writers group invited to Erlangen, in the southern part of Germany, Bavaria. You know, at the end of it, I had the opportunity to visit about 10 German cities, readings and interactions. So I spent, in the company of other writers, a whole afternoon at the house of Bertolt Brecht in East Berlin. That was my first physical encounter with this great man. You know, his bedroom, his kitchen, his garden, and not far from his house was where he was buried. I think alongside Schlegel, also another great German thinker. So later on, I sat down and composed those poems for Bertolt Brecht. So what we have here is an account of my meetings, not just with people, but with writers, with thinkers, and the way places shape the way we think, and who we are, and what we really see the world looking like, and what we would like to see the world look like.
Mm-hmm. And I love that when you go to Alexandria, you think, of course, of the Vanished Library.
Yes.
That's what any reader would think of, I think.
Again, in the company of other writers, the Association of African Literature took place in Egypt for the first time in 2003. And I was there. You know, of course, Cairo was where it was. We had to go to Giza, see the pyramids, enter them, and then Alexandria. The Library of Alexandria had just been declared open. Oh, you know, it was burnt down, you know, many centuries ago. Alexandria was a thriving city, you know, but the library was burnt down. The United Nations, I think the agency of UNESCO, then made the arrangements with the cooperation of different countries in the world, and the library was rebuilt. You know, one of the most significant things I found myself doing before I left Alexandria was to donate a couple of my books for that library.
How thrilling.
It's really great. It is more than symbolic. It is really significant that, the restoration that we need and the primacy of the book.
Oh, that warms my heart, you know. Mm. You've also been to some unexpected places. You have a wonderful long poem called Malaysian Moments that I'm going to ask you to read from. And this is a section you wrote for a poet there.
Yes, Mohamed Saleh. Mohamed Saleh, incidentally, he and I met in Erlangen, that writers' conference in Germany, where we took to each other. Well, we are both members of developing countries in the world, although I have been saying it. Malaysia and Nigeria started the development journey about the same time. Mm-hmm. But now I'm asking Nigeria, how come it you allowed Malaysia to leave you behind? Because Malaysia is really highly developed, very much on the scale of South Korea. And he is a very warm and affectionate human being and an essential internationalist. So this poem is for Mohamed Saleh. Roll down, 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 roll down many rivers. The sky is a boat of songs. Poet, priest, patriot, swift-footed traveler whose heels are wet with many waters, poeticizing in Penang, singing in Singapore, crowing like an ample-combed cock in Kajang. Your voice is wet with many waters. Row, 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 row down the rivers. This earth, too, is yours, from Bukit Mertajau to Oxford, Kuala Lumpur to Leiden, Manchester to Michigan. Places make poems, make people. Your voice borrows a feather from the kukul, clarion from the cockatoo. The higher you fly, the deeper your feet in the fertile holds of earth. row, 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 row down the rivers. It all began that day. The word chose you to be its bride, gave you no choice in the matter, cast magic shadows around your house, led you out of yourself into other selves, bade you sing for your living, prolonged your vision, expanded your hearing, quickened your courage, and lengthened your vision. Now you know what clocks tell the truth, that poverty wears a torn shirt. From a polyglot heap of words, you fashion out a world. Row, row, row now. Row down the rivers.
I think heaven would be you reading to me.
No, thank you.
That is my idea of heaven at this moment.
Let us blame it on your inspiration.
And I love that you wrote about in the introduction how your mother said, the road that takes you away from me will bring you back to me.
Bring you back, yes. That was September 1973. I was already a junior lecturer at the University of Ibadan, one of these universities. And the university gave me a scholarship to go to Leeds for my master's. Yeah, it was after my master's that I became a lecturer. And my mother, that was the first time I would be going away from her. She felt so heavy-hearted, but she was happy at the same time. So when the car that would be taking me to the airport came eventually, my mother looked at this car. Her look was very, very long. And then he cast her eyes to the road. And then looked at me and started praying, typical Yoruba way. And then he said, yeah, said exactly what you said. The road that is taking you away from me will also bring you back to me. And as I said, yeah, the road did. And did so for about 40 years before she too had to take her own road.
Yes. Well, thank you for taking us along on your journey in this book. It's amazing.
Thank you.
We've been talking with poet and University of New Orleans Distinguished Professor Niyi Osundari, whose new book is If Only the Road Could Talk, Poetic Peregrinations in Africa, Asia, and Europe. Niyi, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. Again, as I keep saying, thank you for the work you are doing for the book, for our culture, and for all of us.
The year is a traditional time for looking back, so we thought we'd listen in to some of our favorite guests over the past year. New Orleans writers have produced some great books in 2017. Right now, New Orleans native Walter Isaacson rules the bestseller list with Leonardo da Vinci. When we talked, he recalled the moment he fell in love with his subject.
When I saw Leonardo's notebooks, I mean, most people have written about Leonardo or art critics. And so they base it on the, 12 or so great painting masterpieces. But when I started running across and then searching out the notebooks that Leonardo left behind, I realized there was more than 7,000 pages, some of them in Florence and Milan or Paris or Madrid or Windsor Castle, and even in Bill Gates' home in Seattle. And I realized that I could see a mind that was dancing with nature, that was dancing with imagination, as I just turned page after page of his notebooks. And so that's what convinced me to write the book. And the book is based partly on just looking at his notebooks.
The fiction writer who's had the best year, hands down, is Jesmyn Ward, who received a prestigious MacArthur Fellowship this fall, as well as a second National Book Award for Sing, Unburied Sing. She is the first woman to have received two. In our interview, we talked about grief as the great subject.
I think part of the reason that I write about death and the experience of grief is, of course, because I lost my own brother, right? Mm-hmm. I think before that I was maybe when I was younger, maybe when I was in my 20s, in my early 30s, that I thought a lot about death in relationship to people dying young or dying early, right? And I think now as I get older, that I'm also thinking about what it means to lose someone who is older, right? What it means to lose someone to illness, right? What it means to lose someone in their later years. And so I think that I'm sort of wrestling with all the different ways. Some of my friends have lost older relatives, and something that I said to one of them when I was younger was that I said, oh, it always feels wrong. Death always feels wrong, whether or not you lose someone when they're very young or whether or not you lose your great-grandmother who's 90 years old. It always feels like something that should not happen, even though it's the thing that's always going to happen.
With the tricentennial coming up, we talked with editors of new anthologies about covering 300 years of history. Publisher Brian Boyles and editor Nancy Dixon talked about putting together the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities book, New Orleans, 1718 to 2018, Tricentennial Anthology.
First of all, we had a crackerjack editorial board. In our initial meeting, we were creating these different sections, and then we realized that we were putting the cart before the horse. So what we did is everybody got busy writing and editing and revising. And then when we got all the articles, it was a little more of an organic process. We knew we wanted people. We knew we wanted places and spaces and places. And we also, of course, had to celebrate the city. But we needed to look at what made the city. We needed to look at slavery. We needed to look at civil rights. And we needed to look at, of course, the lighthearted parts of the city and customs that we have that attract so many tourists, but also what really made the city what it is. And sin and spirits and sin and conflict and freedom. We also wanted to end on a positive note of resilience, rebirth, renewal. And so Dr. Michael White's second line seemed like a perfect way to wrap up this book, just like it's a perfect way to wrap up lives and celebrations of the city.
Errol Laborde and Peggy Scott Laborde are the editors of New Orleans, the first 300 years.
One issue we grappled with is that, okay, this is the 300th anniversary. Do we want to go back to 1718 and say, in 1718 this happened, 1719 this happened? And, you know, and the answer was no. We didn't want to do that. And we didn't want to go as heavy on the first 250 years as we did in the last 50 years. So we asked the writers, because you can't tell the story without referring to the past, but to sort of deal with the first 250 years in sort of like a summary sort of way, but really hone down on the last 50 years and be current and keep up with what it is. And I think that's what we got. And we didn't want da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I mean, we wanted people to just throw themselves into it and tell stories and write about the period.
Right. And, speaking of telling stories, one of my favorite chapters is Angus Lynn's, of course.
Yeah.
Long time columnist from the Times-Picayune talking about New Orleans characters. And so we want to keep the drive alive for amazing characters like Black Cat Lacombe, who is such a fixture at the fairgrounds. We also talk about Rodney Fertel, who ran for mayor for many times with the promise that he would get a gorilla for the zoo. And he did, even though he didn't win. He did. So, you know, showing those aspects of New Orleans, not just a straight history, it's about the life and the culture of the city.
There were some memorable debuts this year. Lady Hubbard, who will receive the Ernest Gaines Prize in January, talks about the remarkable family and the talented Ripkins and what her superpower might be if she were one of them.
Everybody has things that make them different. And maybe some people have wants, or they want to write a book or whatever. They want to do something that doesn't always make sense to other people. And so I don't know what my superpower would be. Whatever superpower I would have, I probably already have it. That's another element of the book, is self-acceptance. And I really think that at the end of the trip, that's what Eloise is learning. That was sort of the point of it. Whatever it is that makes you feel alienated or strange, to find a way to accept yourself and embrace yourself for whoever you are, even if other people don't understand it.
Well, I love it when the hammer says to her, how is anybody going to recognize you, Eloise, if you're scared to show people who you really are?
That's right. And I wholeheartedly endorse that. I think that's very true. We can't be afraid of ourselves.
If you want to say your superhero power is writing, I will go along with that.
Well, that's it. Right. I didn't mean it like quite like that. But yeah, it'd probably be that my desire to write, I think, it would be the equivalent of it.
Here's another highlight from The Reading Life in 2017. Morgan Babst wrote about Katrina in her gorgeous novel, The Floating World. Here she remembers her own return to the city after Katrina.
I think it was maybe 10 days after, when it became just remotely feasible to get back in. My father and I came back down from Nashville, where we had friends who had taken us in, and just surveying the extremely strange geography of, you know, your city, your home, covered in mud and patrolled by National Guardsmen, was so incredibly surreal. We went into our house, and I think it wasn't 15 minutes later that we hear shouting from the front hall. There's a man in the front hall who's yelling, you know, FBI.
Oh, no.
It turned out to be an FBI chaplain who had dated my mother back in high school, who had come to make sure that, you know, we were who we should be in our house. But this idea that a place that is supposed to be, you know, safe and familiar can be turned so incredibly inside out was, yeah, life-changing.
Margaret Wilkerson Sexton was nominated for a National Book Award for her multi-generational story, A Kind of Freedom. She tells us how she drew on her New Orleans childhood for that book.
Yes, I spent the first 12 years there, which, as you know, those are formative years. So I just still feel so connected to the city based on just those 12 years alone. I still remember all the television channels from New Orleans cable. I know all the phone numbers that I grew up calling as a child. I know the streets, the food, the accents. You know, I can meet someone outside of New Orleans and I know immediately if they're from New Orleans just by the way that they speak. So those kinds of things never leave you when you grow up in a city the way that I did, because they're the early years that you'll always remember. And not only that, but my dad is still there. So I'm there probably 3 times a year, and I have since I moved. So a lot of it is drawing on old experience. A lot of it is just even drawing on the current truth of the city. And I still have a bunch of relatives there outside of my dad. So just seeing how they've developed in the city and how the city has changed with them and over the years. And yeah, all of that has formed the basis of this project.
For those just tuning in, we're looking back at some memorable moments from the reading life in 2017. Jack Davis gave us a regional classic in The Gulf, The Making of an American Sea. Here, he recalls passing his love onto the next generation.
Yeah, that was a very special moment in the course of researching and writing this book, because I spent my childhood on the Gulf of Mexico and growing up and living on the Gulf for many years of my adult life as well, but originally in the Florida Panhandle on Santa Rosa Sound, and then my family moved down to the Florida Peninsula. And I didn't realize it until I started writing the book that the origin of the book really goes back to those childhood years in the late 1960s and 1970s. I didn't live in a traditional baby boomer neighborhood, combing with children on bicycles and playing sports. It was a lonely experience at sometimes on Santa Rosa Sound, except for the fact that I had the water there and everything that lived in the water and that lived by the water, the birds, the fish, the crabs, the shrimp. And so as I was writing this book, my mind kept casting back to those days, and I realized how special those years on Santa Rosa Sound and on the Gulf were to me.
Jamie Attenberg reads from her wildly successful novel, All Grown Up, which had a little touch of New Orleans as well.
And let me just say, I'm so impressed you found the one thing about New Orleans in this book.
I have radar for that.
It was like definitely a gift for myself. I like to have little Easter eggs in my books for myself to entertain myself. So this is one of those things. Instead, I tell her about some art I recently saw in a small gallery in Chelsea. The paintings were rough and beautiful. The colors were from nature. The man who made them was born and raised in Louisiana, and he lived on a farm with his family, and his subject matter was the nearby swamps. I read his artist statement. It said that he floated on these swamps in a small motorboat every day at sunset for a year, and that's what inspired him most, more than anything else in this world. Not people, not politics, not war, not love, not money, not life or death. Just cypress trees and swamp water and peachy skies and the occasional threatening swish of an alligator tail.
Pamela Arsenault took us back to a scandalous era in Guidebooks to Sin, the Blue Books of Storyville, New Orleans. I asked her about a cautionary phrase that appeared in those books.
The old French phrase, on n'y soit qui mal y pense, or shame to him who thinks evil of it. Many people may be familiar with it as the phrase that is associated with the Order of the Garter, which goes back to British royalty back in the 14th century, perhaps. But about 1905, Blue Books started putting this line in, on n'y soit qui mal y pense. perhaps as a response to the rising tide of progressivism that sought not to just contain prostitution to an area out of sight, out of mind, perhaps, but to eradicate it altogether. So it's sort of evil to him who evil thinks, or shame right. on him who thinks evil of it. We're just having a good time.
That's right.
And last but not least, there were great anniversaries. Pirates Alley Faulkner Society founders Rosemary James and Joe DeSalvo Jr. recall the beginning of 27 years of Faulkner House Books and 20 years of Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans.
Joe and I decided that when we really got into the renovation, and we were egged on a little bit by Kenneth Holdridge, that there needed to be a Faulkner Society because no other writer who had worked in Louisiana had won the Nobel Prize. And he wrote his first novel there, and he brought great acclaim to a city he spent only a year in. And so we thought it was wonderful to start a Faulkner Society and make a nonprofit out of it. And we also wanted to share the building with others. And so this all came as a motivation to start the society. You may recall me talking about this. We, on a lark, decided to call the opening of the Faulkner House Books the first annual meeting of the Pirates Alley Faulkner Society. And we invited 500 people and 450 showed up.
Right.
So we had a wonderful program at Le Petit, and then we followed that with a block party in Pirates Alley. It was a black tie event. And people that night said, you know, we had so much fun. It was so enlightening. You need to do this every year.
And that's a quick peek at the reading life in 2017. Happy holidays and happy reading. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. First, some reading life news. Starting December 31st at noon, the show will be doing its first airings on Sunday. We'll still be on three times a week, Sunday at noon, Tuesday at 1:30, and Wednesday at 8, so keep listening. Room 220 presents readings by Brad Richard, Andy Young, and other local authors, Monday, January 1st at 6 p.m. at Antenna Gallery on St. Claude Avenue. One Book, One New Orleans has narrowed down the shortlist for the 2018 selection. The three books are The People's Grocer, John G. Schwegman, New Orleans and the Making of the Modern Retail World by David Capello, Roll With It, Brass Bands in the Streets of New Orleans by Matt Sacchini, with artwork by Willie Birch, and New Orleans, A Food Biography by Elizabeth M. Williams. Check out the Facebook page for One Book, One New Orleans for info on voting for your choice. The deadline is January 6th. The January 2018 New Orleans Writers' Workshop Intercession Semester begins January 3rd. The workshop, an adult writing program taught by trained published authors, is offering four-week and one-day courses covering creative nonfiction, revision, dialogue, and jump-starting your writing. They'll be in locations around the city all throughout January. All skill levels are welcome. This short session is meant to keep you writing until the full nine-week semester starts after Mardi Gras. Visit NewOrleansWriters.com to register. Major support for the Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.